I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Steve Lopez, award-winning columnist at the LA Times and best-selling author. He's got an upcoming book called Independence Day, in which he considers retirement from a number of angles. And you can learn more and find mountains of Steve's columns at latimes.com/people/Steve-Lopez. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. And we look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 3 p.m. Pacific. It streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, every kind of major podcast site, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. A release from Harvard Shorenstein Center announcing the 2022 Nyhan Prize for Political Journalism brought a smile to my face. The winner was Steve Lopez. I've long appreciated his writing in the LA Times, human, personal, political, empathetic, informative, passionate. And I was glad to see he'd won this award, but I was a bit surprised. Though I consider Steve Lopez a journalist who is political, I hadn't thought of him as a capital P, capital J, political journalist. I would say he writes a column, though occasionally national or global in scope, primarily about L.A. and Southern California. I mentioned the award to a journalist who had retired from the Times a while ago, and he said to me he feels Lopez is one of those columnists, like Jimmy Breslin or Mike Royko, who has a lot to say about how people feel about issues and individuals, like the police or government officials, and I guess that is certainly a political outcome. But to me, Steve Lopez is a storyteller. While the message of a column may be political, it is likely delivered by an individual, identifiable narrator, Steve himself, and delivered through the stories of one or more compelling characters. The Soloist, his column, which became a book, which became a movie, is, I think, a fairly rare case when a column becomes a feature film. It happens, but it's rare, percentage-wise. But just if one knows that story, it embodies the qualities I just laid out. A believable, passionate, sympathetic narrator, and compelling characters in compelling situations. When the Shorenstein Center's award made me take a closer look at what he does and how he does it, I reached out to Steve and asked if we could talk about his career, his evolution, how he sees his role at the Times and in journalism and in the community, as well as his current take on Southern California and the state of journalism. And it was only once we'd scheduled this conversation that I learned that he has a forthcoming book, Independence Day, subtitled What I've Learned About Retirement from Some Who've Done It and Some Who Never Will, in which Steve considers retirement from a lot of different angles. And so I sense he's been chewing on some of those questions for quite some time. Steve Lopez has been an LA Times columnist since 2001. His work at 7 newspapers and 4 news magazines has won more than a dozen national journalism awards. He's a 4-time Pulitzer finalist for commentary. His television reporting for public station KCET has won 3 local news Emmys, 3 Golden Mike Awards, a share of the Columbia University DuPont Award. And Lopez is the author of 3 novels, 2 collections of columns, and the one I mentioned before, The Soloist, winner of the Penn USA Literary Award for Nonfiction, and adapted as a feature film with Robert Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx. His latest book, the one coming out this fall, is Independence Day. Welcome, Steve Lopez, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Terrence, thank you very much for that introduction. You have me sitting here thinking about my own career and your characterization of it as, is it a political column or is it not? And I think that's an interesting question that you bring up. And I don't think of it, actually, as necessarily a political column in the sense of, you know, an op-ed kind of a political column. Yeah, and I'm thinking back on the evolution of how that came to be.
Let me ask you one quick question in the middle of this, which is, were you also surprised when they let you know that you'd won the prize for political journalism?
Well, I think that when you look at the list of people who have won it, some of them were storytellers.
Uh-huh.
And I think that sometimes the best way to make a point, including a political point, is to tell a story.
Of course.
And so I do think that telling stories can be a form of political commentary. But I think what happened, you know, Terrence, this is interesting. I was working at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I was a columnist for, about 12 years, mm-hmm. 80s and 90s. And I began there doing a very reporting-oriented, man-on-the-street kind of a column. And, you know, it was, rather than me shake a fist at City Hall, it was find somebody who had a good reason to shake a fist at City Hall. And in Philadelphia, it's hard to find people who are not shaking a fist at City Hall. Whether it was, you know, about Mayor Rizzo, pro or con, or Mayor Good or Mayor Rendell. And so I was doing that and having a lot of fun doing it while I was still kind of, in the very early stages of figuring out how to write a column or what kind of a column I should be writing. And I kind of... I felt like I was connecting, and I made a big mistake. I thought that I had it all figured out, and I thought that because the column was connecting, that I could begin just sitting at my desk pontificating on the events of the day. And I think the column got really lazy, and it wasn't as good. It didn't have its edge. It wasn't sharp. And the column picked up the pace again when I went back to reporting, because I had to kind of acknowledge, accept that I was not that kind of a columnist. I was not going to take an issue and analyze every aspect of it and sit down and give you the pros and the cons and come down on one side or another. For me, it was the old Breslin style of find somebody, find out their story, filter it through the lens that makes you different from the other columnists, and project that back out onto the page for readers. And when I got away from it, the column was not very good. And then I went on to Time magazine, where I made the same mistake. I guess a short attention span. And I was doing the American Scene column for Time magazine, and also working for Sports Illustrated and for Life and Entertainment Weekly. And I got lazy again. I was doing too much pontificating. And I had to accept that I'm not smart enough to say intelligent things about every issue going on in the city, the state, the world. There are exceptions. There are areas where I've developed a level of expertise, like on homeless policy and mental health policy and housing. But for the most part, I think that I'm pretty useless as a columnist unless I'm finding somebody I want to write about, somebody whose experience, has a natural place it fits into a column that I'm assembling. So it's interesting that you say that about my work as a columnist, that I'm not a capital P political columnist. I agree with you. I agree.
Yeah. And you jumped right into sort of where I was going. One of my questions, just a little. Oh, let me tell people, by the way, we're recording this Wednesday, August 31st. One of my questions was going to be, how does one become a columnist, and how does it differ from an op-ed contributor? And you've begun to talk about that very thing. But in going to your own career, how do you get the permission to write a column where someone says, you know, you're better than just reporting on that city council meeting or that baseball game? You know, we're going to let you go out and figure out what's worth talking about and so on. How does one get that shot?
Well, in my case, I was working at the Oakland Tribune, and we had a new editor came in by the name of Bob Maynard. And Bob had he became the editor and then actually bought the Oakland Tribune. I was at the Oakland Tribune for 6 years and had all four owners that it had had in its history. And Bob came from, you know, reporting. He and his wife worked at the New York Times and the Minority Journalism Program at UC Berkeley Tribune. And it was a time when we had no Metro columnists. And Bob thought that was odd, that the paper had no Metro columnists. And he asked me if I was interested in trying to write one. And I said, absolutely, because a couple of my heroes at the time were, as you mentioned, Royko and Breslin. And I thought, they seem to be having more fun than I'm having. And they get to use humor. They get to use a little bit of attitude.
Yeah.
They get to be personal, but they're also out there, you know, gumshoes knocking on doors and, you know, hanging out in a local tavern and listening to what everybody's talking about, that kind of thing. I really wanted to do that.
Yeah, you know, one thing I can hear, by the way, is that you don't have to be neutral, but you don't have to know everything.
Well, I certainly don't know everything. I don't know much of anything, but Bob Maynard gave me that ticket. It was such a privilege. It was a passport, and I was, I swear to you, and if you don't believe me, you can maybe go and look these up if they're still in the archives somewhere. I wrote the worst American newspaper columns ever written in the history of the country, in the history of newspaper journalism. And I don't think that I'm exaggerating. And the issue was that, and I learned this later on, and I guess I'm still learning it, I had nothing to say. And I went from the Oakland Tribune to the San Jose Mercury News, where I got to work with a writing coach, and the writing coach would look at each of my columns from the week, and he'd read them and look up at me and say, "I don't know who you are. You know, this one looks like a bad imitation of Royko, and this looks like a bad imitation of Breslin, and you're speaking in whatever the language is of the sources in your column. If you're interviewing lawyers, you write like a lawyer. If you're interviewing, you know, if it's healthcare, you write like a doctor. You need to figure out how to write like yourself. And the problem here is that you have no voice. And voice is a term that gets overused a lot. And I sure as hell didn't understand what he meant by it. And he was the guy who told me voice is something you get by knowing why you're doing this. It's not so much what to write about, but why you write. What makes you different? Why should anybody read you? They've got a million other things to do in the day. When they come to the newspaper, there's dozens of stories they could look at, a lot of bylines to choose from. Why should they go to you? If I'm reading your columns in here, everyone that you write, and I don't know who you are, I don't feel like I'm developing a relationship with you because you're not revealing who you are or what your interests are. And it was a real blow to my ego, and I had to accept after much, carping and complaining that he was right. And I was just a very immature young journalist who read a funny Royko column and thought, hey, I want to be funny. Mm-hmm. But I didn't understand what the whole perspective was. Not until I got to Philadelphia and realized that is a town where people are ticked off. And there's like a blue-collar sense there that we're struggling, and we're not making any headway. And when I saw that on every street that I walked in Philadelphia, it took me back to my own upbringing in Northern California in a little industrial town in the East Bay by the name of Pittsburgh, and into, you know, dinner table conversations. And my dad drove a milk truck, and he drove a bread truck, and he sold cigars, and he felt like we were getting screwed by somebody. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yes, I think I understand Philadelphia, but I hear echoes of my dad, and I became a sort of populist, speaking up for the little guy kind of a columnist, and you cannot do that from your desk.
Right.
You got to get out and about. You got to meet people. You got to experience the city. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with column writing in Philadelphia because I loved the characters. I loved their attitudes. I loved how hard they worked and how great their dreams were to get ahead just a little bit, even if it was just a half step or two. And that was where I began to feel like I understood not how to write a column, but what kind of a column I was supposed to write.
Are you getting back to that question that the writing coach had said, why bother? Why do this? Right? And you began to feel like these people, you were luckily in a position where you could sort of push these people's feelings forward.
Well, it was the beginning of my education into the great economic inequities that exist in the United States.
What year? I mean, if we did the math, we could do it, but you can do it quicker. What years are you in Philly?
85 to 97. And okay. So when I got there, it was a post-industrial city. It was, you know, the jobs that made neighborhoods work and sent kids to college, and the pathways to upward mobility were all there. The private sector had union jobs, and even if you had only a high school education, there was the factory on the you know, two or three blocks away that you worked for, or you went down to the shipyards, and you had a way out. You had a way to make a living, and in the post-industrial economy, you had a thriving center city, you know, kind of white upper middle class culture and economy, surrounded by the people left behind by the collapse of the industrial economy. And I began to understand why kids were selling drugs on streets. I mean, it was hard not to notice that they stood in the shadows of shut down factories.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the beginning for me of taking a look at economic and social and racial justice. And Philadelphia just had so much going on, so many grievances by people who were left behind by an economy that changed beginning then and continues to change in ways that support a few and crush the many. So the path that I started on in Philadelphia, I just found another extension of that same journey here in LA, where all of those things were kind of magnified because we have even greater wealth in Los Angeles than, say, in Philadelphia, and we have greater depths of poverty. And in the time since I went to school in Northern California as a lad, we have, I think, just chopped down those ways out, those pathways to upward mobility, and we become more like a third world country. I mean, it's all around us. It's in everything that is a part of an ongoing story in California. It's the state of the schools. It's the state of rising housing costs while wages remain flat. It's as if people have fallen further behind in the last, what would it be, 15, 30, 40 years. So it's like we're moving in the wrong direction.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was just going to say, is that you're seeing the beginnings. I mean, 85 is pre-NAFTA. 85 is just after Wall Street and greed is good, right?
Yeah.
And yet here we are, 15 plus 22, 37 years later, and the path has not changed.
No, in some ways things have gotten worse. And an eye-opener for me in L.A. came, well, every story you work on, there's an eye-opener. You meet people who... But several years ago, I mean, I forget, let's see, this might be at this point 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I bumped into Austin Buettner.
Okay.
And he had just started working as the new superintendent of LA Unified. And I wanted to know how it was going. We had a cup of coffee at the Performing Arts High School in in downtown LA on the edge of Chinatown. And he told me that he had just come from a couple of schools where nearly 25% of the students were homeless. And he said it as in, can you believe this? And can you believe the challenges that I have ahead of me? And I said, what schools were they? And he told me a couple. And so I spent several weeks at one of those schools, and it's in Pacoima. The name of the school is Telfair Elementary. And I got to know the principal, I got to know teachers, I got to know the students and their parents. And it wasn't a case of 25% of the students living in tents on the sidewalk outside, but it was the other kinds of homelessness. It was families living in motels and moving from one to another. It was families living in vehicles. It was families sharing a two-bedroom apartment with two other families. It was families living in converted garages. And that's so much of what homelessness is in LA. We see the tents, but there's this other kind of hidden kind of homelessness. And when I got to know those families, I thought, okay, it wasn't always like this here, so what happened? I mean, that is the school that Alex Padilla went to.
Wow. That Alex Padilla, for those who don't know, rose through the ranks of LA city politics and is now one of the two senators of the state of California.
It's the school that Tony Cardenas went to, Congressman Tony Cardenas. Mm-hmm. It's the school that his sister, Trini Rodriguez, married to the author Luis Rodriguez, went to. Luz Rivas, an assemblywoman. They went to these schools, and this school, I should say, Telfair. And it was a different place when they went, and it was a different neighborhood, and it was a different LA economy. And when I started to check the area around Telfair, I found a number of things that, for me, so much tell the story of LA and of California. I found the shut down Lockheed Martin plant, the shut down Rocketdyne plant, the shut down GM plant, all of those places that had blue collar jobs for people who didn't have the resources to make it to college. And then I found about a block or two from the school, I began to hear people talk about a foundry that had been in the neighborhood that had shut down. And at the same location, is a Lowe's, one of those, you know, home, housewares, construction supplies and all of that. And so that Lowe's sits up there where the foundry used to be. Now the foundry shut down and moved to Mexico, and it still makes kitchen faucets, which are sold at the Lowe's.
Of course.
And so when the foundry was there, those were living wage jobs. Now that the Lowe's is there, those are not living wage jobs. And the foundry is paying, you know, dirt cheap, lowest possible wages in Mexico. And for me, that was the story of what has happened to the economy. I understood homelessness. I understood income inequality. I understood why people are stuck in the socioeconomic levels that they're born into. For me, I'm just so grateful that I bumped into Austin Buettner that day, and he told me that we have here in the richest state in the nation, the fifth largest economy in the world, we've got schools where 25% of the kids are homeless and where housing costs continue to rise while wages don't. And so every social and economic ill that exists is related to this post-industrial economy that was never rebuilt for working people to give them a chance to compete. And I saw the beginnings of it in Philadelphia, and I see it here in LA. And I haven't seen anybody from either side of the political aisle come up with answers. I mean, these challenges, these inequities have existed now, as you say, for decades, 30, 40 years. And I don't know that there's I don't know that anybody on the political in the political game today is talking substantively about how to address that and turn things around for people.
Well, let me see. I think following in this vein, I'd think that two places that might be the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democrats. He and some of his ilk. And I interviewed someone recently, Steve, who was pointing out how things had changed politically in the country, at least, in that Bernie Sanders was a fringe joke in the 90s when the problems were the same. And by 2016, the culture had shifted and the demographics had shifted enough that he was no longer on the fringes, but in dialogue with the president, if not the candidate. The other thing I would say is there is a resurgence of labor unions. And while it's a drip at this point, it would seem to me they're the one other force that really speaks to this. And as you well know, the golden age that some on the right look back to was a day when there was a worthy contest between labor and business, and union membership was 33-35%, and they were a force, and it turned out that worked for everybody.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, there are, I exaggerated in saying that nobody is talking about this. I am disappointed in California, where you've got, the supermajority in Sacramento. You've got a Democratic governor, and we have these continued housing issues and years and years and years of failed attempts to address affordable housing shortages and years and years of failed attempts to address homelessness and years of failed attempts to fortify our schools and to tap all of that great potential and future talent. And those are stories that have been developing in my, what is it now, 21 years here in LA. I don't know that things are better in 2022 than they were when I started in LA in 2001.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's because it's an issue you focus on, an issue that is always ranks as one, two, or three, sort of when you ask folks in California, in Los Angeles, in where I live, Long Beach, which is homelessness. And it's one where you said you have developed, you know, where you can't be all knowing, but you have dug into that one deeply enough. What's your kind of, before you begin to answer, let me tell people that you're listening to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Steve Lopez. He's the award-winning columnist at the LA Times, as he pointed out, for the last 21 years. He's a best-selling author. He does have an upcoming book due this fall called Independence Day, What I've Learned About Retirement from Some Who've Done It and Some Who Never Will. And you can learn more and find a lot of his work at latimes.com/people/Steve-Lopez. What's kind of your take this morning, on this day on homelessness, kind of where we're at, what's working, what we need more of, those kind of angles on it?
Well, that's a conversation that we'd probably need a couple weeks to cover. But I do want to make a point that one of my trusted sources and a good friend, who has been a social worker for many years, said to me recently. And we were on the same page with this. I was thinking the same thing. But he said, we roll out all of these initiatives in LA. And you've got a mayoral campaign now in which the candidates are it's like a duel. Who can promise to house the most people in their first year in office?
Yeah.
I'll do 20,000. Well, I'll match that and raise you 10,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of thing. And what he said was, I don't think they know, first of all, how difficult it would be to do that with the existing resources, because we simply don't have enough. And the other thing is, the easy part is getting people in the front door. The problem is that without continuity in this care system, they're disappearing out the back door. And that has been true throughout. It's been sort of accentuated during the pandemic, when we did a much better job of getting people housed and moved into Project Room Key and, you know, motel situations and other temporary housing arrangements, you know, the tiny homes. And many of them did not stay. They didn't stay for various reasons. The program ran out of funding, or they didn't, they weren't near where they needed to be. They didn't get the support services. And not only did they not stay, but they kind of fell back out of the system. And so that's what my friend, the social worker, meant by everybody's looking at how do we get people in the front door, and they're not watching as people escape out the back door. And this reminds me of a story I did many years ago about a guy who was homeless and lived on the western side of the 3rd Street Tunnel in downtown LA. His name was Ernest. And Ernest sat on a lawn chair and read from a stack of books every day. He said he was studying to take a real estate exam, so he read real estate books, he read fiction, he read nonfiction, just a really interesting character. And there was a lot of violence at the time, and a lot of it was intentional. And there was this this period of so-called bum fights videos, in which people would pay homeless people to beat each other up, and they would videotape it and, you know, put out these videos on social media. And also videos of people just cruising through homeless encampments, beating people up. And Ernest got attacked with a baseball bat.
Ugh.
And he was beaten to within an inch of his life, and he went from the hospital at County USC, later to Rancho Los Amigos, down in your neck of the woods there in the South Bay, to for brain rehab. And this was months and months and months, and one day I was in downtown LA and going through the 3rd Street Tunnel, and there was Ernest. He was back on his lawn chair. He had another stack of books. And I stopped, and I went over and said, "Ernest, what are you doing here?" And he said, I'm just reading a book." I said, "Well, I'm aware of that, but you've had a horrible experience. What, you know, this is not a safe place to be, as you know better than anybody. Why are you back here?" And he said, "Well, where am I going to go?" And I said, "Did they not hook you up with any housing?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Do you have any follow-up appointments?" I mean, his head had dents in it. He had scars from the beating that he took. And he was somebody who got in the front door at the hospital, in his case, got some treatment, and he told me that they'd given him bus fare to go back to downtown LA, and that's where, and he said he had no follow-up appointments. So that lack of follow-through, that lack of continuity, I think is a big part of what's wrong. I've mentioned it both to Rick Caruso, who's running for mayor, and to Karen Bass, who's running for mayor, and I brought it up in the context of each of them promising to house 30,000 people or 20,000 people. And I said, you know, housing them, for many of the people who are quite vulnerable with, you know, multiple physical and mental maladies and maybe addiction, just getting them inside, even with the traditional wraparound services, is not enough. It might be it might take a lifelong commitment, and we simply do not have the necessary army of workers in place to do that. So I think that's a place where there's room for a great deal of improvement, and a good model for it is a program that I just featured in a couple of columns. It's run by the county of LA, and it's called Housing for Health.
Mm-hmm.
And they identify somebody on the street who is vulnerable. They do the work that's necessary to earn their trust, to reel them in. But then it's a team. It's, you know, it's a social worker. It's a housing coordinator. It's a physician. You know, I mean, I went out with the physician who runs the program, and she makes house calls. And these are the things that you have to do with people who, in many cases, have been the victims of trauma throughout their lives. So just getting somebody a key to a motel is not the the end of the care, the support that a lot of people need. And then there's the other problem for them of many times these people are working, but they're working, you know, at jobs that pay, you know, $12, $14, $15, even at $20 an hour, you can't afford to live anywhere. So those things need much, much, much more attention. We lack continuity in the system, with the exception of great programs like that. And I took a trip over to Trieste, Italy, to look at a different mental health model, and went with a lot of LA officials and nonprofit executives. And the plan was to study it and to implement it in a pilot in Hollywood. And it's now 3 or 4 years later, and it hasn't gotten going yet.
And that model was going to be?
That model was going to be John Sharon, who has just left as the director of the County Mental Health Department, told me that you would have a team of, say, 10 people assigned to maybe 100 clients. And these would be clients who had multiple issues. They were unemployed, they were unhoused, they had physical issues, they had mental issues, they didn't have the necessary paperwork to get a job, to get some of their, you know, maybe it's disability. So it would be a team of people to help them with all of that. But then a place that was a center for them, not just a place to live, but a place that was a part of a community. And a place where neighborhood merchants would come to maybe a performance. Maybe it would be theater, maybe it would be music. And they would get to know the clients in this program. And so there would be the entire community wrapping their arms around these people, many of whom at one point or more had been near death. And so the idea is to give them a shot at recovery, at re-engagement, to hook them up with Hollywood companies that might extend job opportunities to them, and just have the whole community buy in, and the whole community know when somebody's out there suffering on the street. Well, I know that person because I met him at this community event. So it was about housing and a team, a caregiving team, and it was about continuity. It was about nobody falling through the cracks. The other thing that was really, really attractive in Trieste, and they were going to try to duplicate here, but good luck in America. In Trieste, there was no delay in giving a person needed care because you had to do the necessary paperwork first. There was no discussion about, well, what agency are we going to build this to? Because that just, you know, so often in LA gets in the way of somebody getting the urgent care that they need, because all of these many agencies, public and nonprofit and private, need to pay their bills, and they need to know, okay, who's paying for this? So the Trieste model to be implemented in Hollywood was intended to eliminate as much as that bureaucratic red tape as possible. The pandemic didn't help. I mean, just as they were ready to begin to implement some of these ideas, the pandemic created greater emergencies that needed attention.
The urgency of other things skipped ahead in line.
Yeah, but I would say that in general with homelessness, the continuity is not there. And the other thing about homelessness that strikes me is it goes back to what Terrence, you and I have been discussing in the first part of this conversation is... nobody should be surprised that there are people living on the streets who have multiple problems and cannot afford housing. I mean, this economy does not work for most people. And it has not worked for most people for years and for decades. I mean, we're looking at in homelessness, in these blue tarps and tents that now are part of the landscape, We're looking at something that each of us created. And, you know, we have created it through our federal and state and local policies about housing and density and affordability and who gets, I mean, I make this argument that people just kind of roll their eyes or laugh me out of the room when I make it, but we chip away at the edges with something like rent control or set-asides for affordable housing, inclusionary zoning. And I became convinced with the assistance of a few professors at UCLA that there's much, 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 much more potential in equity when you want to look at housing and how to create more affordable housing. And what they're talking about is that in California, we have hundreds of thousands of people who bought a house for $200,000 that they later sell for $2 million.
Right.
And so, you know, good for them, right? I mean, they bought the house, they worked, they paid their bills, but they benefited along the way from a whole bunch of policies that were designed, you know, intentionally or not, to make them rich. And that includes, you know, the mortgage interest deduction on the loan that you get. I mean, why, if you're able to afford a house, do you really need that? And Prop 13, which kept property, you know, taxes artificially low so that people buying later in the same neighborhood might pay 3, 4, 5, 6 times as much to finance the people who just by luck of the draw bought in the right time. And then the other thing that has been so instrumental in making housing unaffordable for so many people is single family zoning. And I understand
Yes.
the appeal of that whole aesthetic, and you know, we cherish our single family neighborhoods in LA, but people have over the years resisted any kind of density that might be, you know, much cheaper housing because they wanted to hold on to that single family aesthetic. So the people in those houses have benefited greatly from all of these policies. And my argument, which I have borrowed from a few people at UCLA, is, okay, that's great, but at the time of sale, when you finally sell your house, yes, we know you'll pay capital gains. Yes, we know there'll be a lot of other fees involved, but there ought to be a housing fee as well, because there are a lot of people who will never get into a house because you got so much help from so many different government programs. So let's take a fraction. I mean, maybe it's half of 1%.
Right.
And we're seeing this now with this proposal in LA, and Santa Monica has one, you know, where if you sell a house in LA, what is it, for over $5 million or a commercial property. So I don't think that's a bad idea. The only problem with it is, I think the one in LA is supposed to generate, what, like $80 million a year for housing, at least in theory. The only problem with it is, where are you going to build that housing? Because there's so much opposition to affordable housing. We have all of these projects going up all over LA. I just drove from, you know, east side to west to go to a doctor's appointment. I see construction everywhere, but you know, it's $800,000 condos, it's $1 and $2 million condos, and you know, I guess we need some of that housing, but we need a lot more, and I mean in the hundreds of thousands of units more of housing that people could afford if they teach, if they
Right.
work on your vehicle, if they drive a truck to deliver all of the packages that you need 10 minutes after you order them. I mean, we have an economy that that does not work for the people who make it run.
That's right. Well, and the pandemic at least demonstrated some of that to people. Whether that motivates them enough to do anything about it, but the idea that what is my job essential, or is that guy's job essential?
Yeah,
became defined in a very different way than I think most people would have ever answered the question prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, So I keep, you know, I'm hoping that, I don't know, I think that the Biden administration has had some good ideas about how to rebuild this country. They've been stymied, many of them.
Yeah.
I think other people have had good ideas that are stymied. So even when we get somebody who's on the right track, there's opposition to it. And I understand that opposition when you look at national lawmaking. I just think that in California, we don't have those kinds of impediments. And I think we should all expect more progress in addressing all of this social, economic, racial injustice.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, one of the things that I talk about a lot here, Steve, is minority rule. And the fact that that's what we've devolved to as a national on the federal level, as a national government, whether it's the filibuster or the Supreme Court justices, appointed by people who want a minority of a popular vote, and then have the power to change 50 years of precedent and so on. As you point out, if we look just at California, that excuse does not exist, and the problems still do.
Yeah, you're right about that. You're right about that. And I don't know. I'm like you, you can't do what we do without having some level of hope.
That's right.
And without highlighting some of what you think might be good ideas. So
yeah,
we have to keep speaking up and demand more.
Frances Moore LePay. You may know who she is. She's the one who wrote Diet for a Small Planet. Had its 50th anniversary this year. But she, as much as she wrote that book about food and is considered a food person, is really a democracy person. And most of her work. And she now, she told me that she, and I've heard other people say it since, is that she no longer asks herself whether she's an optimist or a pessimist. She says, I'm a possibilist.
I like that.
And it's why my show is not about a world that works. It's about a world that just might work. You know, it can. It is possible. But I think it's interesting because I confess I don't often think just because of whatever the way I look at things. I don't often think about California's exceptional opportunity, in which case then you could say, well, that's an exceptional responsibility to actually solve some of these problems. And actually, I'd say one of the things that I see, and this is just a note for, you know, we're going to see it this year and probably next year, is as it looks more and more like to me that Newsom is no longer acting as if he's the governor of California in all issues. He chooses a number of them lately, it seems to me, to act as if he is a presidential candidate on a national stage.
Yeah, I...
And we're getting cheated.
You know, I do think, Terrence, that it's coming along more slowly than I would like, but that economy that once existed that you and I have talked about here today was essentially a fossil fuel economy. And I do think that that there could and should and ought to be a new emerging economy. It's already emerged, but a building and growing economy that is about, the science and the infrastructure of healthier living, the Diablo Canyon situation
Yep.
is just a good example of where we need to go. And when I went up there to take a look at it and talk to people who, and you had environmentalists on both sides, people saying, "Well, I'm an environmentalist, and we need to keep this nuclear plant open," and people saying, "I'm an environmentalist, and you can't possibly continue to do this damage to the marine environment and give us the problem for millions of years of what to do with nuclear waste." And I thought they both had some compelling arguments, but the most compelling argument for me was that, continuing to operate Diablo Canyon gives us permission to not rush forward in developing alternative fuels, the wind and the solar, that will be cleaner, that will be cheaper. I mean, when I wrote about it, I've been hearing from people saying, you know, we must have more nuclear power. And it's like, well, what are you talking about? I mean, who in the... I think there are a couple of nuclear power plants in the construction phase in Georgia, but not many, but none in the rest of the U.S.
That's right. That's right.
Not many in the world. And the reason is they are big and difficult and expensive to build, and the power is not necessarily cheap, and there are all sorts of problems. And speaking of environmentalists, the mining for the uranium is not the cleanest enterprise. And I do think and hope that, you know, where Lockheed Martin existed near Telfair Elementary and where General Motors once existed and closed, that you know, we'll see more jobs that are good-paying jobs in this growing field of saving the planet. I mean, we don't have any choice. And so I decided in the end on Diablo Canyon, no, let's not extend its life. Let's rush the switch to the power of the future rather than, you know,
give ourselves the slack.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. I don't know. I mean, if you want to be hopeful and optimistic, come on, we have to. We have no choice. I mean, what are we doing here today? I mean, it's 100 degrees outside,
yep.
And we've got high ozone, and we've got horrible flooding in Pakistan. I mean, the drought deluge cycles that are destroying the planet must be addressed, and the one way to address it is with the development of, the way that we power our lives. And so maybe...
Let me point out one thing that a writer who I think is doing quite a good job at your paper, Sammy Roth, who is the environmental, seems to be the leader of environmental right now. He introduced me to, on a Sunday article back in, maybe it was a year ago, to an economist named Robert Polin, who did a study paid for by the unions, the Steelworkers Union and some other unions, to design a transition for oil workers to a clean tech economy. And the fact that their plan includes that there's a gap right now between what a qualified person who might be leaving a fossil fuel job, what they would make in a clean tech job. And it's a significant difference, like between 125 and 85,000. And their plan says, well, California just pays to make up that difference for a few years. While I just wanted to say that was, in terms of what we're talking about, that was one thing where I went, these people are thinking about it the way it has to be thought about it, and the way no one thought about it when those industries left Philadelphia or when aerospace left Southern California.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm rooting for these kinds of changes in thinking and in jobs, and we just have to. You know, I've got a daughter who's 19. I want her.
Yeah.
There's a lot in the world that's very disturbing right now, but I want to believe in the possibility that she and other young people are going to show us the way.
Yeah.
There are only hope, which is another reason why I think we have to do a much better job of elevating public education throughout the state.
So it's interesting. I as you can probably tell, I didn't nail down where exactly this conversation was going to go. I wanted to get a chance to talk with the Steve Lopez that I've been reading for 20 years. But if I gave you 2 minutes now, just tell us a little bit about the book that's coming in the fall and what you did and where you came out.
Yeah, what happened was that I was working on a novel and had a lunch with my book agent who was visiting from New York. He was in L.A. And he just asked for an update on the novel, and he said, what else is going on? We've been friends for a long time. And I said, well, I'm beginning to think about retirement. And he asked why, and I said, Because I have, because I'm getting old, because I've been doing it for nearly half a century.
Yeah.
And because there are things that I always wanted to do that I have not had the time to do. And I fear that I'll be one of those people who works so long that when I finally do pull the plug, I'm not healthy enough to go out and, you know, hike across, I don't know, hike across Eastern Europe or, you know, spend a few months in Argentina or whatever else. And maybe I will be physically healthy enough, but not remember my wife's name. And I said, I saw these changes in my parents at about the time, the same time they're happening to me. I've got a pacemaker, I've got two knee replacements, I've got continuing health issues. And I said, so maybe I should go and do these things before it's too late. And he said, well, then why not just do it? And I said, because I love what I do. And I'm not sure who I would be when I walk away from what has been a very rewarding, gratifying, you know, soul-nourishing life. And I'm not sure about the identity part of it, and not having a stage, a forum, and I just don't know which way I'm going to go. And he said, give yourself a year, talk to people who are happily retired, miserably retired, people who'd love to retire but can't afford to, people who retired and now want to go back to work. Give yourself a one-year deadline and interview as many people as possible and arrive at your own conclusions. And so I did that. I spent a year interviewing.
And write a book about it.
Write a book about it, right. Give it that one-year TikTok element.
Yep.
And so the book, it's mostly about ordinary people, you know, from, you know, teachers and, you know, it's all walks of life. And then it's a couple of people still working in their 90s, Mel Brooks and Norman Lear. And I talk to them about how they keep the, you know, that creative... Yeah. The creative juices flowing, and whether they even have any choice, because that was another question for me.
Mm-hmm.
If you're curious, and when you see and experience something, you want to write about it, is retirement even an option for me? I mean, you know, maybe it's a mixed blessing. It's, you know, it's a great privilege and also a curse that, and I think Mel Brooks said this to me, how long are you going to be sitting in Barcelona, you know, studying cooking and language and music, and before you want to write a travel piece or a book? And so I spent a year writing about it, and the result, I hope, will serve as a kind of a roadmap, what kinds of things to consider. I got a lot of great advice, including from Mel Brooks and Norman Lear and many, many others. And I came up with a decision that was not easy. And I zigged and I zagged on my way to a decision. And my decision in the end is a bit of a hybrid.
Yeah.
It's to not, you know, to cut back, but to hold on to what to a job that to this day I love, and I can't believe I've been paid to do this for 50 years.
Yeah. No, I followed along with you as you're going through it. And it's a very, let me just tell people, it's a very readable book, Independence Day. It's not that long. And it really is. It's Steve Lopez, you know, if you would, column after column. You know, but as he says, there are people who live at leisure world. There are people who have never retired. There are people who retired early. There are people who are retired and went back to work because they couldn't stand being retired. And meanwhile, he is our narrator, our reliable narrator, Steve, is dealing with all of this and seeing where he will come down come the end of the year. The upcoming book is called Independence Day. The webpage to find lots of Steve's work is latimes.com/people/Steve-Lopez. And for this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 timely articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally, temcnally, @mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on most of those podcast sites. and you'll find years of podcasts there. I've been doing this for over 20. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Steve Lopez. Keep up your good work, and I'm glad you're still doing the column.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Okay.